This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education, by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine.
Plus, global business, finance, and tech news.
The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
The Bloomberg Big Take story in the upcoming new issue of Bloomberg Business Week out on newsstands tomorrow, already online at Bloomberg.com/businessweek. It's also on the Bloomberg Terminal. The story, Tim, taps into how traditional economic indicators, well, they can't predict the timing of a downturn. And then some of the newer forecasting methods, they're just kind of untested.
Yeah, this is why calling a U.S. recession is trickier than ever before, especially with all the mixed signals that we're getting. It is just not easy. We hear it over and over again.
It's not easy
from
being a U.S. recession.
From CFOs. It's tough. Yep. Here with the story, we got Bloomberg News U.S. economy reporter Katya Dmitrieva on Zoom via the 99.1 studio and Bloomberg Bureau in Washington, D.C., along with the editor of Business Week, Joel Weber. He's here in the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. Come on, Joel. I thought this was easy. I thought all you had to do was be the National Bureau of Economic Research and you just, you know, say
wait
yes
for
or
a year.
No.
Look in your crystal ball and it tells you exactly when the recession may or may not come. Yeah, and on top of that, no pressure for economists here because they've had some noteworthy misses.
Oops.
You know, there's that inflation thing and some GDP.
Oh, those old things?
Yeah. So really what's happened here is this: there's been a proliferation of data. Everybody's got an opinion now, right, Katya? And what is the best we can come up with how to figure out how to call a recession?
Yeah, there's a lot of data. You know, in addition to the traditional indicators, you also have all of the new ones, you know, everything from the open table restaurant reservations to where people are flying and if they're flying, if they're coming back into the office, and then even things like plastic surgery. Some economists like to look at that as a gauge of sort of how much people are spending on things that are completely discretionary 99% of the time. So you have a lot of stuff to look at. And unfortunately, you know, unfortunately, it's no easier this time around with this data than it was, for example, during the last recession or pre-COVID, I should say, 2019, when everyone was thinking, okay, we're due for a recession.
The before times.
The before times, the PC pre-COVID times. You know, I think right now, there is some indication of stress. There is some indication that things are slowing down. But the tricky thing is trying to figure out when you're piecing together all these different pieces of the economy, is the image that you get that we're entering a recession, or is it simply a renormalization and kind of a slowing down to something we might have seen in 2019? So that's what's proving very difficult for a lot of economists right now.
I'm so glad we're talking to you right now. We just spoke with Mario Cordero, who runs the Port of Long Beach. And he was saying that, you know, we kind of like tried to hold his feet to the fire.
We did.
And get him to say whether or not we're in a recession, whether or not he sees one coming. I mean, this is a guy who can look out his window and see the economic activity, you know, how many ships are lined up and the economic activity that's taking part. And he wouldn't, he was like, I'm on team soft landing, but he like wasn't comfortable making a call.
We said like yes or no, and he wouldn't do it.
Yeah, he wouldn't do it.
Right. Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's the exact same experience that you're going to get with a lot of other economists right now. I mean, even Claudia Sahm, you know, she created the Sahm rule. This is sort of when you talk about art versus science and economy, this is pretty much as sciencey as you can get. You know, it's a line on a chart. It tracks the unemployment rate over time compared to the sort of past 12 months unemployment rate. And it is very accurate in terms of predicting at a certain point okay, we've entered a recession. And yet, even when I was chatting with her, she was saying, you know, I hope that it's wrong this time around. And there's a chance that it might be wrong this time around, because the consumer outlook is still pretty strong. And we haven't seen a lot of kind of impact, negative impact in the labor market yet. And again, I mean, we could enter a situation where consumer spending manages to hold up, right? So we saw the retail sales figures for the past few months pretty dismal, but we're coming off of that high, right? So we could enter a situation where companies have a bit more room to cut prices now, now that the Fed has kind of done its job and we're seeing inflation slow down a bit. And then we could have consumers saying, okay, I'm going to keep spending. Maybe not like I did 2 years ago or a year ago, but, you know, I'm going to keep this economy going. Everyone's going to keep doing their part. So it's just still a big question mark. I'll you know, 1,200 words later, you know, 20 economist interviews later, and it's still
TBD.
I'll do my part. So what about the yield curve? Because that's then, as you write, a tried and true recession indicator. Does it still hold as much weight as we've always thought, or is it sort of slightly maybe less, and these other things kind of take into account? Like, what's the new, you know, the new thinking on inverted yield curves?
Yeah, the yield curve is a funny one. People love it, and it's a great. It's a great indicator of what investors are thinking and whether they see kind of a recession down the road. And it's pretty straightforward when sort of the short versus long term, the curve inverts. Like, it's a signal. It's one signal of many signals.
But how does it compare with a drop in sales of men's underwear?
Yeah. Yeah, I know. Alan Greenspan's favorite, or used to be his favorite indicator. You know, it's more accurate than a lot of other indicators. The thing with the yield curve inversion, though, is that there could be a false positive. So we had one in the 1960s where the yield curve inverted and we didn't have a recession immediately afterwards. And we also had the yield curve inverting twice, at least twice last year. And we're, you know, I mean, you could talk to some economists and they'd argue we're already in a recession, but we don't see the traditional signs of a recession right this very second. So you could maybe even call that a false positive. So with a lot of these indicators, like, you really have to take them all together. So yield curve plus the SOM rule plus, you know, for example, the Conference Board's leading indicator index, which is weakening and flashing red.
Katya, I'm just going to wait for a year when everybody says, oh, guess what? We were in a recession a year
ago. All of them say, to say, oh, it already happened.
Hey, listen, how does, though, there's a great soundbite in your story, or a great quote about how this is the most traditional recessions in a couple of decades, right? The last two we know, right? We had the financial meltdown, the housing crisis, that's one. And then you had a pandemic that shut down the economy. 30 seconds left here. It being traditional makes it easier or harder to call?
It makes it just as hard to call. I mean, we're lucky this time in that right now we don't have a black swan event, at least not yet, fingers crossed, like we did for the last two, especially the last pandemic recession. But it doesn't make it any easier. In fact, I would argue it makes it harder, because you're seeing, you know, kind of a slowdown of demand, but you're also seeing these mixed signals of like positive things happening in the economy. So I would say it's just as hard as it was before.
That was Katya Dmitrieva. She's a U.S. economy reporter for Bloomberg News. Businessweek editor Joel Weber will be back with us just a bit later.
Really relevant story, right? Especially with that Fed meeting coming this week. It's tricky for the Fed. It's tricky for calling a U.S. recession.
I don't envy those jobs, Carol.
No, not at all. All right. Well, one of the confounding metrics that Katya wrote about was jobs data. Since the start of 2023, we've seen mass layoffs from the likes of Microsoft, Amazon, Alphabet, Ford, also 3M, Spotify, and IBM just this past week. But we had another weekly jobless claims number that showed the labor market still tight.
Yeah, government jobs data still depicting a rather tight labor market here in the U.S. For a closer look at some key job trends, we caught up with Dr. Mona Morshed. She's the founder and CEO at Generation. It's an independent nonprofit that was founded by McKinsey to help prepare people for the workforce. We've got with us this afternoon Dr. Mona Morshed, founder and CEO at Generation. This is an independent nonprofit. It was founded a few years ago by McKinsey to help prepare people for jobs. She joins us via Zoom from Washington, D.C. Dr. Morshed, good to have you with us this afternoon. I want to talk more about Generation in just a second, but first of all, I want to get your thoughts on what we're seeing in terms of layoffs. And I want to look at this in the context of, you know, we're still in a jobs market that's, you know, really, really tight. I mean, unemployment rate, it's historically low still.
Absolutely. So there are a number of things happening right now. Obviously, we're all waking up to headlines every day where there are slews of job cuts which are being announced. That has a couple of ramifications. First of all, obviously, it means adversity for those individuals and those families. But what we're also seeing is that there is a slowdown in new hire vacancies as well, in addition to the job cuts. And so there are two forces happening at the moment. For those individuals who are finding themselves...
A slowdown in new hire vacancies. What does that mean?
So for postings for new hires, there is a slowdown in those. So there's both cuts as well as a slowdown in hiring. So it affects two populations, those currently in jobs who are losing them and those who are applying afresh to new jobs. And so we are starting to see data, at least in the US, of it taking 3 to 6 months for people to find jobs in certain pockets. Now that's a certain picture. Now, important to recognize, the headlines that we see in the US do not apply equally across the world. So we're also seeing other geographies where there's been no slowdown at all in terms of hiring. And we're also seeing that although for tech jobs in particular, you might find slowdowns in tech companies, but there are other companies and other sectors. So it might be in the financial sector, it might be in manufacturing, who are looking to hire for tech roles. And so that's another area of opportunity.
Go ahead, Carol.
Well, right. I mean, does this remind you at all of another job cycle?
2008.
Seriously?
Well, hopefully we don't reach that. I mean, so look, I think what's important is to recognize this is all cyclical, right? And this cycle will take about 2 years to work itself out, if history is any indicator. So we're seeing a crunch and then again, slow hiring, but then it will open up again. And very importantly for job seekers is looking for those pockets where there is continued hiring. And that may not be in the tech sector. So it could be tech roles in other sectors.
So is it safe to say, and just to kind of a little bit of a conclusion here, when we look at the data points that come from the government and elsewhere on the job market, which continue to show strength in the job market, are you saying it's really not the true picture or the full picture?
It's a partial picture, right? You know, so again, there is a partial when you look at which sectors are hiring versus where is there a slowdown. It's partial in terms of, is it a global phenomena or is it a US phenomena? And then there is also a question, I would say, of demographics. Because one thing that I will emphasize is that age matters when it comes to hiring. We've done research and others have done research as well. When you look at what happens when you are age 45 plus, it becomes much harder to find a job. That is why the majority of the long-term unemployed, 6 months or more, are age 45 plus, and that's across the OECD. So age matters here too, and will impact, unfortunately, due to pervasive ageism that we consistently see across employers and across geographies, of how fast can you get yourself back into a job.
So what's the focus for you at Generation in terms of the types of the people who find themselves without jobs, placing them, age range?
Yeah, so at Generation, we support adults of all ages. So from 18 years old to 65 plus. And our learners are typically, you know, so first they typically have a secondary school degree background. Over half are female, the majority have dependents. And we are either placing them into their first job, or we are supporting those who are age 45 plus and who may, for example, have been spending the last 10 years working in retail or in logistics and supporting to put them into green jobs or into tech jobs or whatever it might be. So what we do is train and place learners into careers that otherwise would have been inaccessible.
So I want to go back to something that you said earlier about this being reminding you of 2008. And, you know, if we go back to 2008, the unemployment rate was 10%. Right now it's at 3.6%. So what else about the environment right now that you're seeing out there tells you that this is similar to back then? I'm just not seeing it.
There's an element of what I'll just call copycat behavior, which is when employers start to see that some companies are doing layoffs, it starts to make everyone much more conservative. And that is with regards to new hires. And so the question for us is, because we are often placing people into entry-level roles, irrespective of which profession it's in. And so you start to see it taking longer to get people into roles. So it's not that they will not make it, but you know, whereas before we could support someone within 3 months, it might now take 6 months. And we're seeing this also in the reticence of employers to also commit to saying, you know, these are the vacancies which we're going to have this month or that month. Everyone is watching and waiting to see what happens. In addition, the IMF recently came out to say that, you know, a third of the world's economies are going to go into recession this year, which is a big deal. So 2023 is very much a watch and wait and observe type of a year.
So, you know, Mona, earlier you said the government data, it's a partial picture of what's going on in the U.S. labor market. So having said that, based on what you're saying, it sounds to me that very soon we might see some of this show up. Is that your expectations?
The expectation is absolutely that over the coming months, we're going to see, not just for the U.S. economy, but for the world, how resilient is the hiring going to be. And it will obviously, nothing will ever be true across the entire world, but it'll be in pockets. Mm. So you'll find some sectors, you know, clearly the tech sector is heavily affected right now. But you may not see that same trend in green jobs or in healthcare. And so this is why it's so important to look at the picture sector by sector and not just economy wide.
Older workers, do we need them?
Absolutely, we need them. You know, I think the age 45 plus population is a remarkable asset that should be much more employed than is the case.
You have a bunch of people around the newsroom and our audience who are listening, and they're like, when did 45 become old?
Because when you look at when you look at government stats, the majority of the long-term unemployed are age 45 plus.
Wow. Right?
As soon as, you know, I say this to you as a 51-year-old, I recently had a birthday. And so, thank you.
No, but it's interesting because, you know, we talk about aging demographics and the impact it can have on a country's economy, right? We've talked about it certainly with Japan. We've talked about it with the U.S. increasingly. We've talked about it even with China, who's seeing an aging population mm-hmm. and the costs that that has in so many different ways. I don't know. I'm not quite sure what the smart question, I mean, should we be putting these people to work? Isn't that better for the global economy? Or Tim, what do you think?
Well, I have one question for you, Mona, 10 seconds, okay? If somebody really young is listening right now, thinking about what they're studying in college or studying in you know, trade school, what should it be?
Yeah.
I get this question frequently. No, so look, I'm going to give a practiced answer,
just
which
quickly,
is-
yeah.
Very quick.
It's about how quickly you learn. It is often not about what you learn. It's how quickly you learn.
I like that.
Interesting. All right. Some really thoughts in terms of today's labor market. Dr. Mona Morshed, founder and CEO of Generation via Zoom from Washington, D.C.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekdays from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live to our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Well, a wind turbine taller than the Statue of Liberty collapsed last June in Ames, 90 miles northwest of Oklahoma City. And a few days later, another one, Tim, collapsed in Colorado.
Yeah, the instances are part of a rash of recent wind turbine malfunctions across the U.S. and Europe, ranging from failures of key components to full collapses. Writing about it in the new issue of Bloomberg Business Week is Ryan Bean, industrials reporter for Bloomberg News. He joins us along with the editor of the magazine, Joel Weber. Both are in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. This story, by the way, it's in the new issue of Business Week. It's out on newsstands later this week. You can already read the story online at Bloomberg.com/businessweek. And of course, always on the Bloomberg terminal. Joel, I want to start with you. How bad is this? I mean, do we, you know, are these things like falling all over the place?
Hard to know. No, but the bigger story here is that As sustainable sources of energy have become so much more cost effective, everybody's been scaling up. So turbines have gotten bigger, bigger, bigger. It's like, just imagine steroids, and these things have gotten massive. And at the same time, maybe the same quality control hasn't been going into these products as they've gotten bigger. So Ryan, what does this mean for the companies and for the rest of us who have to, you know, live with turbines that might snap and be flailing around in the wild?
Sure. Well, first of all, I don't think most people who live near or have these turbines in their community need to be super, super worried all the time. But right now, it means that companies are just paying a lot of money to address these quality issues. I mean, just a few days before we published this story, Siemens Gamesa, one of the largest wind turbine manufacturers in the world, announced, you know, a pretty significant charge totaling hundreds of millions of euros related to, you know, premature component failures in their turbines that were already installed. I mean, GE has taken, you know, similar charges for to fix, you know, issues with their fleet of installed turbines. And I think, you know, one thing that's important for listeners to understand is, like, this industry is still kind of in its, I guess, call it an adolescence, if you will. I mean, we've seen, you know, just not only turbines themselves get bigger, but projects get bigger and volume going up. And these companies have had to sort of race to develop a supply chain and refine their manufacturing practices to go along with that growth. So I think that a lot of this is sort of like growing pains to a degree.
And what do we know about the factors? Are they external factors that are coming to bear on the turbines, or is it the turbines themselves that seem to be faulty?
It can be, it's tough to say. It's a little bit of both, right? I mean, in one of these instances, you know, that you mentioned at the beginning of the show, some officials from the operator of the wind farm told, you know, the local county commissioners that it was due to a blade flaw, and that you know, four other turbines had experienced the same blade flaw that caused, you know, similar failures. And then, you know, over the course of our reporting and, you know, some of the other publicly reported you know, collapses, you know, some of them have been linked to construction issues. Some of them have been linked to defects with componentry. You know, so it's a variety of things. It's
nobody's
not just one
been
thing.
Hurt though, right?
I don't know if nobody's been hurt, but okay. But none of the instances that we reported on had any injuries involved. No.
What's interesting is it's not just land turbines. This also happened at least in one instance to an offshore wind turbine, as
that's
you
right.
describe in your story. And I'm wondering, Ryan, I see stories like this and I think about the politics of wind, because it's very political.
Sure.
You know, if we think back to what happened in Texas a couple of years ago, during the deep freeze, when some wind turbines stopped working and generating power there. And then you have all these offshore wind projects in communities around the country that are creating a lot of tension in communities. Is a story like this just ammunition for opponents of wind power?
I'm sure that opponents of wind power are going to look at this and point to this as evidence of, say, we can't keep rushing to push these things out all the time. But then again, you know, as you point out, wind has always had its detractors, right? I mean, from, you know, local community residents you know, opposing an offshore wind farm because it'll disrupt their beautiful coastal views, or you know, concerned you know, fishermen who are worried about an offshore wind farm will disrupt their livelihoods. You know, wind has a variety of you know, of groups and folks who are opposed to this. I think there's always going to be a contingent out there that will, you know, look for reasons to slow down this technology.
You know, I'm curious, Ryan, if in your reporting, that as a result of what's happening, and I highly recommend everybody check out the story either online or in the magazine later, and I don't know if we have pictures to put up on our YouTube and Bloomberg Quick Take streaming service, because to see, like, the blades bent, it's just like...
It is, like, crazy. Right? It's like carnage.
Yeah.
Came through here, and yeah. You're so used to just seeing them slowly turning.
These
in the
majestic
wild.
Machines,
yeah, they're
just,
you
know,
like,
providing
ah!
clean power. No, when they go wrong, it's, I mean, when large, I mean, large infrastructure can sometimes fail, right? And that's sort of by its nature, when it does fail, it can be really, really dramatic. And, you know, frankly, that's sort of what got me interested in this, you know, early on, when, you know, over a year ago, when we would see a couple of reports of a turbine failing in Europe or a turbine failing in the US. So just, you know, recently after General Electric, which is one of the main companies that I cover on an ongoing basis, when they took a big charge in the third quarter last year, I decided to really sort of dig in to figure out what's really going on here and how much of an issue is this really.
Well, let's stay with that. How did CEO Larry Culp characterize that those expenses when these things come up, you know?
Yeah, I mean, what he said was that, you know, that charge is about a $500 million charge to basically reflect that the amount of money that they were going to need to set aside for warranty coverage and for repair campaigns was about twice as much.
Who knew there was a warranty on these puppies?
Yeah. Oh, no. Yeah. Everything has a warranty, including wind turbines. Yeah.
You take the serial number, you write it down, exactly. You mail it in.
Yeah. I just see this, you know, the tech on the front. Where is the serial number on this thing? Where do I find this? I mean, these things are huge. And the reason I know they're so big is, you know, just driving in the desert in California years ago, but those are tiny compared to what you see these days.
They are.
I've been on the highway before and you see like parts of these things mm-hmm. being taken to places and you're like, wait a second, that is just like one turbine. How big are these?
I mean, the largest blades that are coming out now for offshore machines to be installed in the not too distant future, they're as long or longer than a football field in some cases.
For a blade.
So imagine that. Just imagine that for a moment. Blade. And there's three of them.
Yeah.
And I'm glad you mentioned the transportation issues. I mean, some of the factors that are going to limit how big a turbine can be in any given space is not necessarily related to what's physically possible with the technology. It's like, can you get a blade to a farm on a piece of land in the middle of rural Nebraska or what have you? Can you fit them on the roads? I mean, how do you maneuver a truck carrying a blade of that length, you know, around a corner? It's a fascinating industry, and the scale of the stuff is sort of awe-inspiring.
And of course, the insurance premiums will go up.
Of course they will. Incredible read. And like we said, check out the pictures. We threw them up there for streaming and for YouTube. But check it out online and on the Bloomberg and, of course, in the magazine. Ryan, thank you so much. Interesting story. Ryan Bean, industrials reporter at Bloomberg News, here in our Interactive Broker studio, along with the editor of Bloomberg Business Week magazine, Joel Weber.
When cybercriminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekdays from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live to our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
We dealt with the integrated oil companies because we know that they're going to be reporting earnings. With that in mind, as well as a big development last month, you know, when scientists in California made that key breakthrough in nuclear fusion, we wanted to talk a little bit more about what's going on in this space.
Yeah, we're reaching out again to an organization that blew our minds away when we did our remote broadcast from the New Jersey Institute of Technology last year. Very pleased to have with us Stephen Cowley, Laboratory Director at Princeton Plasma Physics Lab, here in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. We also got a special guest with us joining us this afternoon. Will Wade is Bloomberg Power and Renewable Energy Editor. He's joining us today as well for this conversation. So we're excited to have Will with us as well.
So, Stephen, let's start with you. First of all, so great to have you here with us. I know that there's been all of a sudden a lot of attention. Tell us and remind us about the significance of what happened in that California lab and how you guys think about it at your own lab.
Well, the big thing that happened was that they produced an experiment in which the fusion energy that came out of the capsule was more than the energy they had to put in.
Which they hadn't been able to do before.
First ever. Right, and a magnificent achievement. They got 3 megajoules out. 1 megajoule is the power of a hand grenade. Wow. So they got a power of 3 hand grenades coming out of this experiment. That's pretty significant from an object that was about the size of a peppercorn.
So how do you harness this energy and replicate this?
Yeah, piece of scale. Cake. Now we can just go off and running.
Easy now.
It's been done in a lab, but how do you do it to power our homes?
Well. Ultimately, fusion is going to be a very sophisticated steam engine because you're using the energy that powers the stars, which is fusion, joining of small nuclei together to make bigger ones, in this case, 2 kinds of hydrogen to make helium. And you're using it to make heat. And then you're using that heat in the very conventional way to power a turbine and make electricity. And that's the goal, right? And we're now seeing tremendous excitement about taking these kind of scientific results and turning them into something that's commercial. And that's going to be hard.
Do you, Carol, do you have, you know, Christopher Lloyd and Michael J. Fox in your head from like Back to the Future, Mr. Fusion,
this
powering
is real.
The DeLorean?
This isn't a movie,
This is
Tim.
Legit. This is actually happening.
All right, let's bring in Will Wade. As we mentioned, Power Renewable Energy Editor at Bloomberg News. We love talking with Will. So Will, come on in. You have been reporting on this space. Join our conversation. And you've talked with Stephen before.
I have.
And what is it that, you know, you think about in covering this space and what you want to know when you pick the brain of somebody like Stephen?
Well, I guess the key question is how long is it going to take? And the answer always seems to be quite a long time still. We're many, many years out, decades probably. But we should not discount the achievement that they had in California last month. That really was amazing.
All right, so why is it decades, Stephen? Help us through this.
It's decades because at this point we have just lit the fire. We have to make a furnace. And we have to make a furnace that operates 24/7. We have to make a furnace that then, you know, integrates a number of technologies that haven't actually yet been tried. Inside a fusion reactor, you have to make part of your fuel. Mm-hmm. And so you use part of your fusion power to actually make one of the fuels that you then put into your fusion system. Never done that part, right? So there's a lot of work to do.
Right.
I always say to people, I think we know we can do it. The question now is, can we do it at a price you want to pay for your electricity?
Well, can we?
I think we can. I hope in my lifetime, but, you know, I'm getting older.
Is it safe?
Fusion has this nice quantity that's really hard to do.
You said grenade earlier. That got me a little concerned.
Yeah.
You got a problem with that, Tim?
A little bit.
It's a bad analogy, isn't it? Yeah.
No, it works.
One of the good things about fusion is that it's very easy to turn off, right? It goes out unless you sustain it.
So it can't, like, I guess it I can't have this vision away. Of, like, things like, you know, ricocheting off and all of a sudden.
Are you thinking of a meltdown?
A meltdown in a fusion reactor. So the safety prognosis, and we've done analysis of what future fusion reactors might look like, is that fusion reactors could be put next to cities. Fusion reactors could be placed where we now have coal-fired power stations. They could replace in all aspects our current generating capability, and they have these very favorable safety prognoses.
Yeah, the safety about fusion is actually one of the things I think is really cool about it. You mentioned meltdown. That's what we think about when you think of a typical nuclear power plant which uses fission. So the thing with a fission plant is it's relatively easy to start that type of nuclear reaction. But it's harder to turn it off. That's why they have the cooling pools and all sorts of other things to try and control that. With a fusion reaction, it's much harder to get it going. But if somehow you lost control of it, the thing that's fun about it is that it shuts itself down like super instantly, fractions of a second. So safety is not the biggest concern.
You know, I'm thinking, Will, about where we are as a society and what we've seen over the last year in terms of energy transition. The world is so reliant on fossil fuels. We're going to talk with you about nuclear energy in just a few minutes. But where do governments come in when they're supporting technology like this? Because wouldn't it make sense if everybody just got together and said, hey, we're going all in on fusion?
You got to show me the money.
Yeah.
And on something early like this, it always has to come from government, some kind of subsidized loan or grant programs. Things like this cost a lot of money. And in the early days, it's hard to get, you know, commercial investment in something that's so risky. So you always have to start with government money.
What's been interesting over the last 4 or 5 years is that venture capital has come into the business.
Right.
And in the last year, I think we, in the last actual calendar year, we had about $2.7 billion of investment into fusion startups. So that's...
So private money.
Yeah, private money generating a set of new ideas and a new energy into the business. And this may propel things forward a lot faster than we're currently going. But there are some fundamental problems to solve. And I always say the most important thing to happen is smart people. We need smart people. Because this problem is solvable, but it needs some innovation.
Well, I feel like every time I go to NJIT, which is where we talked with a colleague of yours from the lab, like this whole idea of STEM education and how important. My dad was an engineer, worked on the space program, but that was, it was a cool thing for people to be engineers. And I just feel like I don't know if there's that same momentum for people to do that. You talked about having, first of all, the skill set and the people we need to do all this, because there's still a lot to be done to make fusion, I guess, a reality on a grand scale. I mean, do we have the talent out there to do it? Do we have kids getting the right education to make sure we can carry through to the finish line, if you will?
I think young people are very motivated by climate change in a way that my generation probably weren't as strongly. And we're getting huge numbers of applications to grad school, to undergraduates, wanting to work in the space, particularly of fusion energy. I mean, who wouldn't want to work on an energy source that powers the stars, you know?
Right. It feels like kind of the next moonshot, although we took a big step closer, right, in December.
Is the ultimate goal of this, Dr. Cowley, that we have fusion-powered power plants?
Oh, sure. And it's sort of the perfect, it's the perfect energy source to marry with renewables. Because you could turn it on, you can turn it off, and when the sun doesn't shine and the wind doesn't blow, you have a source of energy. It's got this one problem, you know, to actually make fusion happen, you have to recreate the conditions in the middle of a star. And that's very hot, like 200 million degrees, and hold that together while you make the reactions happen. So it's also rather cool.
Well, that's what I think about, like the level of heat intensity, right? And then having the materials, I'm assuming, right, to make it safe as you do that. So, or is that not such a problem?
So the way, in my laboratory, we deal with that is that we hold the fuel in a cage of magnetic field. And you just hold it suspended so it doesn't touch anything.
Right.
Because if it touched anything, it would just get cold. And, you know, heat it up. And we've taken things up to 500 million degrees.
Okay. That sounds pretty hot.
It's hot.
Go ahead.
This is one of the reasons why we wanted Will Wade to continue to join our conversation. He's renewables reporter for Bloomberg News. And he's got a big take out today, along with Jonathan Tyrone, all about nuclear power. So we go from fusion to fission. And the idea here, Will, is that we're at a time when the world wants to decrease its reliance on fossil fuels. And here in the U.S., about 50 years ago, and around the world, we built a lot of nuclear power plants. The problem is now these nuclear power plants, they're approaching middle age or beyond.
Middle age or beyond, yeah, they're definitely getting old. The thing is, in the last year and a half or so, I've really seen in the industry a big shift in views on nuclear energy. There used to be a lot of people had sort of just a gut level negative reaction to nuclear, just sort of a fear of the risk.
Well, they lived through Chernobyl.
They did.
Three Mile Island, Fukushima.
All of those are real things. And there's still a lot of people that are just vehemently opposed to the risk from nuclear energy, but a lot of those same people are now starting to realize that the potential risk from nuclear accidents is outweighed by the very real risk of what we're seeing from climate change. And now we're realizing we need that carbon-free nuclear energy to achieve our climate goals.
So, Steve, you understand both fusion and fission, so and nuclear power. I mean, is it time for us to continue with some nuclear power because we have to because of the climate, or is it, or should we not be? I mean, you understand the space, the radioactive waste that doesn't go away as we wait for fusion to be a reality on a grand scale. How do you see it?
I think we've got to do fission until we have fusion.
You do.
Because I think the enemy right now is climate change, and it's accelerating. We see all the impact that it's going to have. And the big surprise of the last few years is how renewables have come down in price, and they're doing a terrific job in that sector of the market. But you've always got to back that up with something that's there when the wind doesn't blow and the sun doesn't shine. And fission can do that. We know how to do the technology. We have to do it more efficiently than we've been doing.
What does that mean, more efficiently?
Well,
building
new nuclear power stations is a very expensive business, and the cost overruns on every project that I've ever seen are phenomenal. It's about managing those projects in a better, more efficient way. And delivering fission at a cost that we really want to pay.
Yeah, part of the problem is that we have not been building nuclear power plants, so we've kind of lost that skill set. We don't have a veteran workforce that knows what they're doing. All the ones that are happening now are kind of one-off projects, which is exactly why they're taking much longer and costing so much more. The only U.S. nuclear power plant under construction is in Georgia. It's Vogtle. It's been under... It's like 7 years behind schedule, and the budget has doubled to $30 billion. But it's supposed to be finished this year.
You talked about a younger generation caring about climate change, so they want jobs in fusion. Younger generation that cares about climate change, if you're saying that fission, nuclear, is also part of the equation, do they want to work at a nuclear power plant, a younger generation? I'm just curious.
I think that's a harder sell. But yeah. I think we should be working on that, frankly, because I think, this is the way to get to net zero. And if you look at any of those plans, like the one we have from Princeton, NZAP, Net Zero America Plan, right? That plan basically relies on either carbon capture and storage or fission to fill in the gaps.
Is carbon capture, Will, something that is...
I'm skeptical.
Yeah?
Yeah. I mean, I think the technology can work, but can we make it work cost effectively? I think that's the question. I have a lot of questions about carbon capture.
It's literally what it sounds like. It pulls carbon out of the environment.
You put something on the smokestack of a coal or gas power plant, you trap the carbon, and then you inject it underground.
Send that carbon back to where it's from. Go ahead, Dr.
I think of those two technologies as being transition technologies. Huh. Neither one do you want to do for decade after decade, because you're going to have to bury the carbon dioxide somewhere. And again, with fission, you do have a long-term waste issue, and you don't want to do it for decade after decade.
I was going to say long-term, really long-term.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which is why you want fusion. To replace.
Right.
Deadly for thousands of years.
Well, having visited a nuclear power plant and looked at the pools with the rods, it's pretty startling and pretty like a reality. Renewables, wind, solar. What percentage do you think that they will ultimately be long term? Or is it something that ultimately will...
Well, in a lot of these plans, they're producing 60, 70, 80% of the net. It's just the gaps that become their problem. If we have fusion, that might change that environment a lot.
What about battery technology improving faster than fusion?
I think the challenge with battery technology is long duration storage. Batteries are good at short duration, but for instance, in Britain, we have Decembers in which there is no wind. And of course, no sun, because it's Britain. And you have to store up all the energy to power the country for the whole of December. That is enormously challenging with batteries.
Now you live in the Northeast, where the sun shines 365.
That speaks to California.
Well,
exactly. Just got about 30 seconds left here. So what's the next thing when it comes to fusion that we should keep on our radar that you think we might see in the next year?
Well, I expect the NIF results to get better over the year.
Their next test is in February. Right. Hopefully they'll replicate what they did or even do better.
They're on the edge of a cliff of what we call gain.
Yeah.
And, you know, they have a gain. They put in 2 megajoules. They got out 3 megajoules. I could see them going up to 10, maybe 15, possibly, over this next year. That would be phenomenal.
Okay, I'm Googling megajoule. What's a megajoule?
A megajoule.
A megajoule. Oh, sorry.
Megajoule, a unit of energy. And it's a
unit of energy.
It's about the energy of a hand grenade or a candy bar.
That's right. That's what you said. All right,
we start with the hand grenade. We end with the hand grenade.
And the candy bar.
Oh, my gosh. Please come back, both of you, because that was just kind of what we were hoping to do and just share that with our audience. Steve Cowley, Dr. Steve Cowley, Laboratory Director at Princeton Plasma Physics Lab. And, of course, our own Will Wade. He is Power and Renewable Energy Editor here at Bloomberg News. Thank you to both of you. Really appreciate it. Thank you.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekdays from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live to our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Well, I have to say, shocker today on the global stage as the news came out that New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern announcing she's stepping back in a shock resignation ahead of a general election later this year. You know, keep in mind, she was the world's youngest female leader when she led her Labour Party to power in 2017. She's basically saying, and she told reporters, I don't have the energy or inspiration to seek re-election. So stepping back.
Yeah, she told reporters, as you mentioned, that she doesn't have the energy or inspiration to seek re-election, which I was pretty surprised. If she can't do it, Carol, What hope is there out there for female leaders more generally? And with that, we want to bring in our next guest.
Yeah, Hope Dimachowski is Senior Executive VP and Chief Financial Officer at the more than $13 billion market cap First Horizon Bank. Based in Memphis, she joins us via Zoom from Memphis, Tennessee. Hope, nice to have you here with Tim and myself. A lot we want to talk to you about, but when you see a headline like that or somebody else in the C-suite, that's a woman that steps down or resigns or whatever, and then isn't replaced by another woman. Like, how do you think about it? Because are you seeing, you're in the C-suite, you're CFO at First Horizon. Do you feel like women are really making inroads when it comes to the C-suite?
Unfortunately, I agree with your introductory comments. Is absolutely when one person leaves, like that we've had, and it's actually the second one for us because we also lost the English Prime Minister earlier this year after a very short time. And with such a few women representation in certain industries and fields, when one leaves unexpectedly, it definitely has a big impact on all of us. We feel that, you know, each one of us, we want to go up in numbers. We want to have more representation, whether it's a C-suite or in top layers of government. So it absolutely hits us all each time we see one of these senior women step back from any type of role in an area which is significantly underrepresented.
Based on your experience, how do we get from underrepresented to accurately represented?
Great question. Yeah, I think it really comes with a conscious effort. But I think the data has shown in Harvard Business Study, the great study on this last year, is diverse companies that have high diversity at the top, it just continues through the company. So the more that we get diversity in the C-suite of women, people of color, the more that you see your company start to change. People want to work where they can see themselves in that role. I do a lot of on-campus recruiting through a couple different companies that I've worked for in recent years. And the number one thing I hear from diverse talent, both women and minorities, is what does your C-suite look like? And I can't see myself getting there if I don't see people like me there.
No.
So I think representation matters.
Yeah, it speaks
to go after top talent.
It speaks to belonging, right? Like if you don't see it, like how can you feel like you belong there or you know, it's a good fit? How tough was it for you to work your way up?
That's a hard question to say how tough. We each have our own journey, but there's definitely a different path. You know, I started my career in investment banking in New York City. When I started with Deutsche Bank, they had 100 leadership development graduates in the U.S., and they had 3 women. So I was the diversity candidate, 20 years ago. I think the hardest thing has been trying to find mentors and trying to find people that can help you along your route. Just got asked on a panel this morning here in Memphis, you know, do I have a problem finding male mentors? The answer is no. I've had lots of great male mentors and allies. I have a harder time finding women that have been in the C-suite or have been at big companies that can mentor me and work through those situations with us.
What about the pipeline? As you know, not necessarily C-suite executives yet, but those who are in their career, maybe, you know, midway through their careers. How do we make that more equitable? Because that's what gets you to the C-suite.
Yeah, there's a broken rung, especially in banking, but in a lot of industries when it comes to women and minorities. And it has to be constantly having allyship, constantly having mentorship, and having purposeful recruiting at all levels. Salesforce did a great job 2 years ago, I think it was, might be three, kind of lose track of time with COVID. Mm-hmm. But they had done a equity study, made sure they had equal pay at all levels, and really made a conscious effort to even it out. And 2 years later, they found out they went backwards. So the unconscious bias, it's there. And so if you're not tracking it, if you're not measuring it, if you're not making a conscious effort, we're not making the progress we need to make.
You know, it's interesting too. I mean, did you ever feel like at some point though, you're like, it's just really, really, it sounds like you've had a pretty good trajectory and good people behind you helping your way. What was the most difficult time though in your journey? As you say, everybody's journey is different, but was there a point where it was tough?
Multiple times. I can't tell you how many times I've sat down with my husband and said, I'm not sure this is for me. Mm. You know, being a wife and being a mother of three, when your work and a job situation or I've dealt with a lot of bias in my career, unfortunately, when that takes away your ability to feel good about yourself, it impacts you in your other areas. And so many times I've had my career impacted with changes. I've had somebody make a comment to me that was very sexist or inappropriate. And every single time it made me question, is this what I want to do? Is this the environment I want to work in? And it's why I'm so passionate now that I have made it to the C-suite and I'm lucky to be one of the women doing mentorship and doing conversations like this and sitting on panels so that other women can know it's not easy and it's okay to be hard. It's okay to question yourself some days, but you need to each one of us just figure out what was the right thing for you. And each one of those times I came back and said, okay, I'm going to continue on. I'm going to continue with this company and I'm going to be the one that makes the change that other women don't experience this.
No, it's some really good points that you're making and important to see individuals like yourself so that a younger generation and other women coming into the finance space or the banking space can see somebody in the spot and aspire to that. Since we have you, we'd be crazy not to ask in what's an uncertain, volatile market environment, economic environment, recession, no recession, how are things looking?
Every day is a new look at the market right now. You know, we are in unprecedented financial times in the U.S. and across the world with COVID, the changes that we've had, the issues we've had with supply chain to the fastest rising rate environment that anybody that's currently in business has ever seen. And so I think we just have to continue to look forward and look at where we can make progress in small areas. But we have a bumpy couple years ahead of us coming out of where we've been. And whether we're going to see a recession or not, there's a lot of different opinions on it. But I think, you know, the latest inflation
news was positive.
Do
you think recession likely this year?
I do. I think we're going to, my personal opinion is I do think we're going to head into a small recession this year. Hopefully it'll be not too strong and not too long, but this inflation issue is just really stifling us and it has taken too long to get it under control.
Just in the last 30 seconds that we have, how small of a recession, what would tell you, like what would be the worst of it?
You know, I actually don't have an answer for that. I try to be the best case scenario person, so yeah. I don't know what the worst case is. I try not to go there, although, you know, we have to for running a bank and modeling, but I don't think we're going to see a worst case. I think the Fed has taken a lot of very aggressive action with interest rates to make to bring the inflation under control, and they have signaled as well as said they're willing to take larger action if needed. So I don't believe that we'll have a large recession. The Fed's doing everything they can to prevent that.
All right, Hope, really appreciate your time. Hope Demichelski, Chief Financial Officer at First Horizon Bank, joining us via Zoom.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekdays from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live to our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
A story about how startups are getting created, are creating what they are doing. They're getting creative, I should say, when they are in the hunt for crash and for cash. Can I try that again?
You got it. It's Wednesday. I know. That's, these things happen, Carol.
It's hump day. Just like they're getting creative, I'm getting creative. But some of that creativity is raising eyebrows.
Well, we got a great voice with us. He's quoted in this story. Ken Smythe, he's from Next Round Capital Partners. He helps startups obtain financing. He's with us right now in the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. Ken, good to have you with us. You know, As we heard Charlie going through the markets, you were telling us a little bit about, you know, your impressions of Elon Musk and, you know, how he overpaid for Twitter, excuse me, ahead of Tesla earnings this afternoon. The environment has shifted so much just in the past year. What are you seeing in the work that you're doing when you're out there helping startups raise money?
First, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. Yeah, we're seeing an environment which has drastically shifted in the last 12 months, particularly. I think investors obviously are kind of coming off a very, very rosy scenario, which was 2020, 2021, where multiples were sky high and people were paying for growth at any cost. And now we're back to fundamentals, as they say. And investors are really focused on when companies are going to be profitable, when they're going to be cash break even, and particularly what multiples are they paying now for that future growth, given interest rate headwinds, the Fed, and a potential recession.
So a smarter market today in terms of focusing on fundamentals, where it got a little stupid when there was so much cheap money for so long?
It got super crazy. Some firms, and I won't name names, were doing, you know, 10 deals a week, right? How can you keep that pace and really be doing serious diligence on these companies? So what we're seeing now is really kind of a very much a pullback, a very much focus on what's going to work not only now, but in several years from now, and durable business models.
What I want to ask you, Ken, is though, in a market like this, does it create companies that will ultimately be your Googles, your Facebooks, dare I say Twitter, you know, the companies that actually have longer legs and sustainability going forward because of the focus on fundamentals?
Absolutely. You're going to see companies that really were sort of cash burning machines that needed venture capital to continue growing. Right. They could continue to feed losses. And a lot of the consumer models, if you look back at Casper mattresses, if you look back at Lime, at Bird, these were ideas that just consumed massive amounts of money that VCs had to continue funding at ever raising rounds and ever raising prices. And when that's working and money is cheap, it's great. You can run a business like that all day long. But when the tide goes out, as Warren Buffett says, you know, look out below, right? Investors are just not willing to fund those losses indefinitely.
So what's the environment that exists right now in the context of the new companies that are out there being created? Are we in a more normalized world of, you know, I don't know, the 1990s perhaps, where we see interest rates not at zero?
Right. So now I believe we're in the sort of 2009 period, called 2022, 2008 for the venture capital IPO market.
That's pretty severe.
Where everything ground to a halt. Wow. And 2007 was 2021.
Okay. Right. But what came after that? It was like the best time ever to be a venture capitalist.
That's right. And a lot of the venture capitalists hadn't seen a 2022 yet. Remember, a lot of these firms got started in 2010, 2011, 2012.
Right.
All they knew was a bull market. If you were an employee working for a startup, you got all these options and all you saw them is go straight up, straight up, straight up. And you never sold a share and you were the smartest person in the world, because then you had the IPO, the lockup, and you were rich. And that's all you had to do is just keep doing that over and over again. Now venture capitalists are starting to have to think like hedge fund managers almost. They have to say, you know, if Chime was at $25 billion a year ago, and that was at 100 times multiple, and now Chime is trading at $10 billion, and potentially if it was public down to $6 billion, should I have sold a lot a year ago? Do I need to start actually managing a portfolio? Right. Because this whole buy and hold thing in the VC world isn't going to work in every environment. It kind of, they got lucky and it worked for a while, but it's just not going to work in
Dublin. Chime, one of those startup, you know, so-called neobanks.
That's right.
So what does this mean for startups who do need cash? I mean, right. Hema Parmar, who wrote this story, she's our hedge fund reporter here at Bloomberg News. She talked about how startups are having to be creative in terms of the hunt for cash. So what are they doing?
Yeah, I think
what does that mean and what do they have to promise or what do they have to do?
I think early stage startups, if we define the world by early stage, mid stage companies, Series C, Series D, and then late stage post Series E, when you really have a business going on, I think a lot of what I was talking about in the article was companies that have already raised money. They have significant businesses going on, 100 million, 200 million, 300 million in revenues, but are still burning cash, right?
Right.
And so they have a certain amount of cash, and kind of 2002 was sort of a freebie. 2022, sorry, was a freebie. You raise a lot of money in 21. You had plenty of cash to get through 22. Now you're hoping as a CFO, you wake up and this all goes away, right? Because you don't want to go out and raise money at a 40% discount or a 50% discount to what you did in 21.
Hence the down round, right?
Not only that, but you got employees and executives to keep happy,
right?
And if you wipe out their equity, guess what? You got a lot of upset people walking around the office saying, hey, what did you do?
So what do they do?
So this is going to be the interesting part. 2023 and mid part this year into 2024 is the rubber is going to meet the road. Every CFO is going to have to say, what's this? Where are we going with this? Do I keep growing my business?
Right.
Or do I dilute my investors and wipe out my equity of my employees? Right. And that's going to be the big dilemma. So you see companies like Sneak that just did a down round. They got a major free pass, only down 15%,
not bad,
from their previous round. If you can do that, you should do that all day long. But I think companies, but Sneak is in a SaaS software high margin business, so they can probably get away with it.
Right.
But if you're Instacart trying to raise money now or GoPuff, good luck.
Yeah, we've seen, I mean, we've written about the challenges that those companies are facing quite a bit in Business Week. So I guess my question is about the types of businesses that are going to come of age during this period of higher rates and, you know, where the money isn't free anymore.
That's right.
Are these going to be just better businesses? Are you optimistic or are you kind of
I'm
worried?
Very optimistic.
You're not
I'm
concerned.
Almost glad this has happened,
Why?
Right? Because it's making CFOs and companies actually have to be aware of cost, be aware of how much money they're burning of investors' money to grow these businesses.
You mean
be
responsible
thoughtful about hiring
yeah.
and hiring and right-sizing your organization and not just throwing money at problems. Because that's what everyone got punched drunk on free money. So if you're just punched drunk on free money, you're going to hire as many people as you want. You're going to invest as much money into sales and marketing.
So
you're going to go after bad product ideas, and they may or may not work. But do you care? There's this VC standing by and wanting to give you more money.
Correct.
What are the opportunities then?
The opportunities are in virtual reality, companies like Anduril. The opportunities, although I think it's a...
Anduril, the defense
that's
company.
That's right. I think companies like Anduril...
Lucky company. He's the guy who created Oculus, sold it to Facebook. Now he's trying to take on the likes
right.
of Raytheon.
That's right. Anduril is one of our top requested names. Obviously, let's not talk about OpenAI, but OpenAI is kind of the new, let's just say, darling of the private world.
Right.
And we're going to see a shakeout in that world. I think I can... that world to when Yahoo was the leader in search and then Google came along and actually made it a business, right? And so that's what we're kind of seeing with AI is who can actually make it into a workable business model.
Right.
We're seeing a lot in logistics and transportation, companies like Flexport. Mm-hmm. And then we're also seeing a lot of the SaaS businesses, which do cloud data storage, AI, machine learning, Databricks, Data Robot, companies that actually are helping businesses be more efficient with very high profit margins in the interim.
Hey, Kit, does it also mean that companies will go to public sooner rather than later?
I don't think so. I think we're in a very interesting period where investors are willing to pay a certain multiple. And
right.
if you look at public company multiples that are comparable, and if you're a private company CFO, you might say, you know what, it's probably better to stay private for right now.
Because, I agree, but because it's a different environment, there isn't so much cheap money. It's not going to force some companies to have to tap the public markets. Do you think there'll be enough out there?
I think that when companies do start raising money again in the private market, if the appetite is there and they can do it at the right price, they're going to try to stay private until the market recovers, and then you can go public at a higher multiple. Remember, businesses in software that are growing at 20% are selling for 5x multiple in the public market. You know, a lot of these private businesses are trending 25 times more plus.
So that trend continues because it's something that Tim and I talk a lot about. It just kind of floors us when we go to different conferences. We were out at Milken. It was all about the private markets. That trend continues that the private markets are going to continue to fund so much out there. Just got about 30 seconds.
That's right. Look, a
that
lot
doesn't
of the,
change.
A lot of the best ideas are the early stage ideas. VCs, if you're a VC that caught OpenAI early, you're sitting on 100 times your money. that is where the real money is made. You got to catch them early enough, though. So, you know, many times once they get too late, just like Uber had raised so many financing rounds, by the time it went public, it went down 40%.
Yeah.
So, you know, you just got to catch the timing right. But this is innovation. We're going to pay for it. There's going to be a bull market again. And, you know, stay positive and look at fundamentals.
All right. We certainly will. Ken Smyth, thank you so much. Next Round Capital Partners founder joining us in our Bloomberg Interactive studio. Check out Hema Parmar, our hedge fund reporter at Bloomberg News. Her story talks about exactly what Ken just laid out for us.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live. Live weekdays from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live to our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
So Elon Musk, also the subject of this week's cover story, which notes that if he has a tragic flaw, it isn't his temper or his treatment of underlings or his refusal to follow securities laws. Nope, it's that he's extremely and painfully unfunny.
Which is kind of funny.
That is kind of funny.
All right, so let's get to it. With us is Bloomberg Businessweek columnist Max Jafkin and Bloomberg News technology reporter Dana Hull. They wrote the story, the cover story of Businessweek. Max is here in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker studio. Dana, on the phone from San Francisco. Nice timing, guys. This is what we are all leaning in on. Dana, I'm going to start with you because, you know, Elon, I always feel like, you know, that he, for a long time, could do no wrong to some extent, and everybody was all in, and then things changed. What happened?
Yeah, I mean, 2022 was sort of a remarkable year for him and for, you know, and for all of us in a lot of ways. But I mean, you know, this is a guy who was Time and the FT's Man of the Year or Person of the Year for 2021. And then, you know, and then in 2022, he bought Twitter. And in order to buy Twitter, he sold billions of dollars worth of Tesla shares. And then once he took the reins at Twitter, he fired everybody and started to interact with a pretty, like, sort of rogues gallery of characters, you know, right-wing folks, anti-Semitic folks, conspiracy theorists, and, you know, for a long time, old-school early adopters of the Tesla brand, this was very, very alarming. And I think what you saw was that because Tesla and Elon are so intertwined, I mean, there is, like, the brands are the same, basically. There was a real erosion of the Tesla brand, and, you know, in marketing surveys, in just conversations with former employees, in conversations with potential EV buyers. And that was really something that Max and I wanted to explore at this kind of pivotal moment for the company.
Hey, Max, come on in here, because I was, you know, I was having this conversation with a friend recently who has bought two Teslas, and I was saying, what do you think of all the stuff that Elon Musk does? And he was like, you know what? I don't care what this guy's a Musk fan. Okay.
Yeah.
He's like, I don't care
you
know, the CEO of Disney does. I don't care what the CEO of, you know, these other companies. And I said, you know what though? But the thing is with Tesla and Musk, like the two are inextricably bound to one another.
Yeah. I mean, when we talk about Tesla's brand, it's different from talking about Ford's brand or Chrysler's brand or something like that. As Dana was saying, that's, there are two reasons for that. One is this kind of Musk as the centerpiece. You know, for years we talked about how amazing it was that, you know, Tesla didn't spend money on advertising. I mean, it's been a big, huge part of the way this company finds people. And then the second thing is it's still a very strong brand. Musk is doing things that are hurting the company, and that sort of, as Dana said, like longtime investors, some longtime fans have found uncomfortable. But it's not like there aren't fans. And you know, yesterday, while we were listening to the earnings, right, Tesla put the numbers out. They're sort of okay. There was a sort of beat on revenue, and it's kind of a mixed bag, and the markets weren't doing anything. And then Musk gets up during the call and says, you know, we said we're going to make 1.8 million cars, but we just might make 2 million cars, you know? And the stock went berserk at that point. And that's where it had this huge jump. And so the thing is, when Musk still does kind of like the Musk thing, which is, you know, talk about how great Tesla is and how many cars they're going to make and make these like wild
promises. No demand problem. No demand problem.
Investors like that. And they're still going for it. It's when he starts talking to Cat Turd, to pick on one of his you know, interlocutors on Twitter, that people start to feel uncomfortable. So it's not like he can't walk back from this, it's not like he can't come back from some of this damage, but there has been a shift, and it's reflected in the stock price. Even though it's gone up today, it's still, you know, half of what it was, more than worse than half what it was, you know, before this Twitter stuff started.
Dan, it is kind of remarkable, some of the things that he does and some of the investigations that are happening. He was up on, this whole week, right, on the witness stand talking. This is not typically what you want of a CEO of a publicly held company. You know, does he not get it? Like, what is it about Elon? Like, he's got to be seeing the headlines, the news. He's got to see the stock drop. Like, does he not understand that some of these things he does is not so good?
I mean, Elon reads everything about himself. I mean, I think he probably gets notifications for himself on Twitter. He read our story. He read our cover story. But I think that he's gotten whatever his shtick is, he has gotten away with it for a very long time, and it works for him in the way that it works for President Trump. I mean, like him or hate him, people see him as an unvarnished, authentic character. I mean, he says what he thinks. Sometimes he's rude. You know, he called like the public county health officials fascists on earnings calls. He told analysts that their questions were boring and boneheaded. He thinks that Joe Biden is a damp sock puppet. I mean, he says what he thinks, and people like that. They like that authenticity. They respond to that. And it keeps him in the news, and it keeps him in the conversation. And even if he's in the conversation for bad reasons, he's still in the conversation. I mean, I think if you interviewed a bunch of people on the streets of Manhattan and asked them, who's the current CEO of GM, Ford, Fiat Chrysler, or BMW? Like, I don't know if they would know who it was. But, like, people know who Elon Musk is, and that helps. You know, ultimately, I think it helps him.
Hey, Max, to that end, and what Dana was talking about, it doesn't always go well for Elon Musk. What happened at a Dave Chappelle show recently?
Oh, yeah. This was the way we opened the story. And it was, I think, Dana's idea, just because it was such a contrast from kind of the response that Musk normally gets when he's in front of a crowd. You know, he gets up there, Dave Chappelle, performance in San Francisco, sold out crowd, giant arena show. You know, Dave Chappelle, of course, is a controversial comedian. You know, a lot of his act is about, railing on, the dangers of woke culture and things like that. You know, in other words, these are people who you would think would be fans of Musk's kind of right-wing, transgressive Twitter stuff. And they weren't. They were booing him. And just seeing that kind of turn, I mean, that's where we got the idea to write the story, because just like seeing that turn was pretty dramatic. And it really, and yeah, like Musk has a big fan base. They love him, just as Dan is saying. On the other hand, it's not clear how much more growth Tesla has. They need to grow to be so much bigger to justify the current valuation.
Danny, you did say he read the story. Did he respond to you guys? Wait.
I'll let Max take
it. I think I can.
Quite a response. I mean, it wasn't like a direct response, but he, like, someone quote tweeted it, and then go ahead, Max. You want to read it?
Musk was talking about the story with like a handful of like Dogecoin influencers. Dogecoin being the his favorite cryptocurrency, and they were kind of saying like, "No, you really are funny, Elon." And he was responding like, "Thank you." So not exactly a direct response, but certainly talking about it. And then on the earnings call, there was a very interesting moment where an investor asked, about the sort of potential brand damage, citing a poll that we cited by YouGov, which is a scientific pollster. And Musk essentially said, YouGov schmoogov, I got 127 million Twitter followers. And it was a really interesting moment because, first of all, a little bit of a window into what his strategy is, if you're trying to find a strategy with Twitter, it's like, hey, I'm out there, I'm in the news. Just like Dana said, people are talking about it, so it must be good. It also was a bit of a turnabout from the way Musk was talking about Twitter, several months ago, when it was just like, oh, these followers are fake, you can't trust them, and so on. So super interesting moment. And I read that also as a response to the story.
Well, it's an incredible story. We've run out of time. We could talk forever on it. It does make me wonder, God, if he didn't buy Twitter, would we still be, I don't know, where would we be? But who knows? Guys, we got to run. Cover story of Bloomberg Business Week. It's a killer. Bloomberg Business Week columnist Max Chapman and Bloomberg News technology reporter Dana Hull, they wrote it. So check it out, the new issue on newsstands, online, and on the Bloomberg.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline, it's teamwork, and it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest-growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle-market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at stiefel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekdays from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live to our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
When you think about the best watches in the world, you probably think of brands such as Rolex and Patek Philippe, some others as well. There is, though, a group of indie watchmakers that are taking the luxury market by storm, thanks in part to a supply crunch affecting some of those top brands. That is the subject of the opening story in the Pursuit section of the magazine this week.
And much of this section is actually dedicated to so-called timepieces, as we call them here at Bloomberg Pursuits.
Is that what we call them?
We do. We have with us our in-house expert and super fan on the subject, Pursuits editor Chris Rouser. He knows a thing or two about watches. Also joining us is Bloomberg News reporter Andy Hoffman. He covers retail and the consumer. He's based in Geneva. So Chris, is it, you know, I think of you as the Bloomberg watch guy, but is it possible that Andy actually knows more about watches than you do?
It's I almost hate to admit it if I wasn't so proud of him, but Andy actually is really the true watch industry expert. You know, he's based in Geneva and he covers the Swiss watchmaking industry. There's a lot going on, and it's been a very fascinating beat in the past 5 years because this industry has really exploded, which is why we're doing this story now. As you said, all of these major watch brands are having supply chain issues. They're not increasing production as demand has increased, and so people are turning to other less famous brands, and they're learning a lot more. And you know, you almost don't want to put it in the context of it being hard to get a Rolex or a Patek, so you're looking at these other brands, because these other brands are actually very interesting on their own, and they're very accomplished, and we love highlighting them.
Yeah, and it's funny because when I first started, I'm like, they're going to be less expensive, but really cool. I kind of kidded at the earlier with Tim. I'm like, we could even afford them. He's like, no, we can't.
There are some that you can.
All right, Andy, come on in on this. You know, you and Chris were talking about this coverage. Tell us about these, what we're calling indie brands.
Yeah, well, Chris is absolutely right. I mean, what we've seen, you know, during the pandemic, you know, consumers, in particular U.S. consumers, sort of fell back in love with mechanical watches, most of which are Swiss. And that created great demand for, you know, the classics, the well-known brands like Rolex or the Montpiguet, Patek Philippe. And in those brands, they just don't make a lot, and the demand for Rolex is so high, even though they make a million watches a year, that these independent brands have been able to sort of jump in and fill that void. And also, people were spending more time online. They were doing their research much better, and they became more exposed to these brands. And so brands like Ming, which is a very interesting brand, it's only, you know, Horology Ming, it's only 5 years old. It's actually based in Kuala Lumpur. The watches are Swiss made, and they're making these really interesting sort of groundbreaking watches that use, you know, luminescence and light and design in sort of very interesting ways. They only sell them on their website. But, you know, these watches are being sold at auction here in Geneva, you know, alongside Patek Philippe, Audemars Piguet, and Rolex now.
I'm really intrigued by this 36-year-old, Ming Teen. You know, you think he's, you know, a watch guy, but then you write that he's not just that. He's a photographer, he's a designer, and a private equity guy? Who is he?
Yeah. He was, he worked in private equity for a couple of the big firms, worked for some, Asian money managers, graduated, from Oxford at, you know, in his teens. I mean, obviously he's a really bright guy. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, artistically, gifted. I mean, he's a great photographer and has always been a watch collector, is what he's told us. And, you know, at a certain point, he was collecting all these watches and he said, you know, and this is only, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, and he said, you know, I'm going to give this a try. And so he and a few colleagues and fellow collectors started Horologer Ming, and they've done extraordinarily well. I mean, they started, I think their first watch was selling for around 900 Swiss francs. Now, most of their watches sell for around 5,000 francs. Some sell for 10,000, and they're even making watches that sell on their site at retail for 20,000, 60,000 francs. Very rare.
Chris, start with, you know, what you guys call, you know, the one that's like a blue chip sure thing. And I think right. This is it F.P. Journe?
Yeah, Andy, do you want to talk about F.P. Journe? This is, I've loved this brand for a while.
Yeah, I mean, F.P. Journe is sort of the big heavy hitter, blue chip, independent watchmaker, based here in Geneva, French-born, you know, just makes extraordinarily complicated, exquisitely finished watches, which now, you know, the brand was founded in the 90s. He started producing watches under the F.P. Journe brand in, I think, 99. Now these watches sell alongside Patek and Audemars Piguet at the auctions, well over, you know, into the millions. I mean, they're just, you know, he is an extraordinary watchmaker. He is an extreme talent. And, you know, the watch world has slowly but surely woken up to this. And now he's, you know, at the sort of pinnacle of the game.
I want to talk about this timepiece. It looks like two watch faces are conjoined. Horological machine number one.
You mean the watch that isn't for you?
Indeed, that's Max Bucer, who is all on his own in terms of the way that he, you know, him and his company, which is called MB&F, Max Bucer and Friends, have decided to approach watchmaking. We got to spend some time with him. Max Bucer is clearly an artist, and he surrounds himself with artists, and they are making what they feel is art for your wrist. And so, you know, he makes watches that look like panda bears. He makes watches that look like frogs. He makes watches that look like spaceships. And, you know, inside them is extraordinary horology. And yet, you know, the designs, the case shapes are like nothing anyone has ever seen. These watches sell for well over 100,000 francs. You know, but he also makes some watches that are slightly more traditional, although nothing that Max Bucer does is traditional. But last year, he and a fellow watchmaker who's, you know, one of the friends, a guy named Stephen McDonald from Northern Ireland, who designed the movement and the complication, made a what's called a sequential chronograph, which is basically two chronographs on the same watch, running, you know, through the same movement, and it allows you to do all these things with one chronograph on your wrist that you know just wasn't possible before. I mean, they're really, you know, pushing the bounds, doing new things, and they're being awarded by the industry with the Grand Prix de Horologie de Genève GPHG awards. So Max Bucer is the, you know, a prime example of the wider watch public waking up to these independent makers. It used to be just for the watch geeks and the freaks, and now everybody knows about them.
Geeks and freaks.
A chronograph is a timer, by the way, so that you can do a lot of different things with that watch. I remember when I started reporting on watches almost 10 years ago, and I learned about this brand, and it was not, like Andy said, it was not something that people knew about. Only watch geeks knew about it, and now these things are much more in the mainstream, and lots more people are lining up to buy them.
Andy, we can't see you right now, but Chris is wearing an Apple Watch because you're in Switzerland. Okay. What are you wearing on your wrist, and what do you think of Chris's Apple Watch?
First of all, I mean, Apple Watch is a very interesting and clearly carefully designed watch. I'm wearing a Swiss brand called Norkane, their GMT watch. I think we actually wrote about it in December.
You did.
And I just actually visited them today. Very interesting. And that's another independent brand. Norkane, what they are, is basically making pretty classic watches, but they're making, you know, and they're an independent brand, but they have great distribution. They're about 5 years old, and their watches are now available in the U.S., Switzerland, Japan, and they're in that that 2,000 to 5,000 franc or dollar range, which is actually used to be quite crowded, and now, you know, the trend in the industry is for everybody, you know, like Omega and everybody in, you know, brands like Auris, another independent brand, to move up in price. And so there's a vacuum or a void there for reasonably priced watches.
That's Bloomberg Pursuits editor Chris Rouser, along with Bloomberg News reporter Andy Hoffman, joining us from Geneva.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekdays from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live to our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Well, the companies that we talk about each and every day, you know, they begin as ideas, maybe in a garage in Silicon Valley or perhaps in a rented office space in Albuquerque. But from that idea to an actual functioning business can be a rocky road, Tim.
Yeah, you got to beg investors for money. You got to manage a growing workforce. You got to figure out how to scale. And ultimately, if you're lucky, you'll get to a successful exit, whether it's an IPO or an acquisition. But it is a tough slog. If only there were a handbook for entrepreneurs.
There actually are. Next guest says he has written one. Ori Levine, he knows a thing or two about building a company. Co-founder of Waze, which, as you know, sold to Google for $1.15 billion back in 2013. He was an investor in MoveIt, which Intel bought for $1 billion back in 2020, Tim.
He's got a brand new book out. It's called Fall in Love with the Problem, Not the Solution, a handbook for entrepreneurs. He joins us on the phone from New York City. Ori, how are you? Good to have you with us.
Thank you. I'm excellent. And yourself?
We're doing well, thanks. We're very pleased. Congratulations on the book as well, Ori. I'm wondering about, starting this idea in terms of, like, you know, thinking about not just this handbook, but about your own journey as an entrepreneur. What does it mean to fall in love with a problem?
So essentially, you know, when you fall in love with the problem remains your North Star of your journey, right? And when you have a North Star, then at the end of the day, you're less likely to do deviations from it and more likely to actually get to your destination. But there is another major part of it, right? Because the story that you're going to tell when it's associated with the problem is way better than the story that is associated with the solution. If we will be here in 2007 and I will tell you that I'm going to build an AI-based crowdsourced navigation system, then you would say, yeah, right, but you don't really care.
Well, what was the problem? What was the problem, though, that you were trying to solve in 2007?
I'm going to help you to avoid traffic jams.
All right, that's... It worked.
And then you do care.
It's pretty, you know, every time, and I am an all-in fan on it. And, you know, I will say my husband's like, kind of laughs at me because when it's like there's a car on the road, I'm like, I hit it and I, you know, contribute to it. You've gotten the world to buy in and help you in this process. Is there something, though, in society, Ori, that you think, though, has changed? We talk so much about the sharing economy, the sharing society. Is there something different that enabled a ways to be created that couldn't have been created maybe 20, 30 years ago, beyond the technology component of it?
You know, I think that in general, people are like to help each other, right? And so we are, in general, people are good. And if you create them the opportunity, then they will be happy to share. They will be happy to create value for others. And the magic of Waze is that we, the drivers, are helping the rest of the drivers to avoid traffic jams and to know what's going on the road. And essentially, it's sort of a social network of drivers that we are helping the rest of the drivers.
What's a problem in today's world that needs to be solved?
Besides that, my puppy needs to be trained.
There's an app for that.
I wish.
There's probably an app for that. Right? But at the end of the day, there are a lot of problems, right? And because when we think of different issues, and by the way, when we started Waze, you know, traffic jams today are more severe than they were when we started Waze. Yeah. And we actually were scheduled, our mission was to help drivers to avoid traffic jams, and traffic jams today are even more severe, right? And so we are not done with addressing mobility, and MoveIt actually did a better job in addressing mobility by making public transportation easier. But we are still not done. And, you know, one of my startups is trying to address parking because it's a major issue. And many of my startups, each one of them is trying to address a different problem.
I am curious how you look at some of the companies that were once startups but are now behemoths in the technology space but are having a tough time, aka Facebook, now Meta, Tesla, Twitter. Like, how do you look at them? Because just because you're a startup and it and people can be excited and you can do well for a while, it doesn't necessarily mean you have legs. But how do you look at some of these companies as somebody who's created companies and companies with legs?
So let me ask you the following, right? And this is really how fast the world is changing, right? Google and Amazon and Netflix are about 20-something years old, right? And then Tesla and Facebook and Twitter and Airbnb are less than 20 years old. They were amazing entrepreneurs at the beginning that had a mission to change the world. And in their journey, they have made the world a way better place, right? Just imagine that we will have a time machine, and I will send you back 15 years into 2007 or 2008, right? Just before we started Waze. And that means that I'm going to take away your iPhone and Waze and Uber and Netflix and pretty much everything that you're using every day. It's unclear that we will survive. So when we create a solution to a real problem, it's guaranteed that we are creating value. And when we create value, we are likely to become successful. Now, whether or not we are looking at the valuations that were here in the last couple of years or the valuations today, it doesn't really make the difference in the value that those companies have created and in the goodness that they have created.
You know, there was a saying that companies oftentimes, like in, you know, before the pandemic, you'd see startups get ridiculous funding rounds and they were in search of a problem to solve. What's one company that you saw or a startup that you saw that you passed funding on because you said, wait a second, this isn't out there solving a problem?
So most of my startups are actually self-made, right? So I was looking at a specific problem and then find the right team or maybe the team came to me very early phase, right? So way before they even started with a problem that they would like to solve. And I basically say, this is a problem worth solving. And so my recommendation will be, think of a problem that is worth solving, a big problem, something that the world will become a better place if you address that. And then ask yourself, who has this problem? Now, if you happen to be the only person on the planet with this problem, then I would say, you know what, go to a shrink. It's going to be way cheaper and faster than building a startup. But if a lot of people actually have this problem, then what you really want to do next is go and speak with those people and understand their perception of the problem. And only then go and build the solution. Now, if you follow this path and your solution works, it's actually guaranteed that you are creating value.
Well,
and the essence of all startups is to figure out what is the value that we are creating.
Got it. Ori, we have to leave it there. Ori Levine, co-founder of Waze, his new book, Fall in Love with the Problem, Not the Solution, a handbook for entrepreneurs, something he knows a lot about. This is Bloomberg.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live each weekday starting at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live on Bloomberg Quick Take every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.